Support comes from Russell Reynolds Associates. Call them change makers. Call them rule breakers. We call them redefiners. Join host Nanaz Motashami and CEO Clark Murphy as they engage in purposeful conversations with leaders in and out of the business world who share their insights and perspectives on how they lead boldly. Fresh ideas and tangible takeaways. Redefine your own leadership trajectory no matter where you are in your journey. Listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
Weeks after Afghans fled their country, resettlement agencies in the U.S. are scrambling to find new homes for thousands of people.
We are resettling today in a few weeks the number that we would have resettled over an entire year in the last few years.
Many of the Afghans already in the U.S. are unaccompanied minors, eager to start their new lives.
The first questions are, can I go to school? If I go here, will I go to school?
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, after 16 years of Angela Merkel, Germans are electing a new chancellor.
We don't like change in Germany.
And clothing retailers normally worry about fashion trends. These days, the head of one company has bigger worries.
I do wake up every morning and actually get a satellite view of the ships docked outside the port of Long Beach in LA.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is Friday. Thank you for being with us. The images of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan will be seared into our minds for a long time. The chaotic rush of tens of thousands of people desperate to get on a flight out of the country, among them Afghan children separated from their families. It is hard to know exactly how many unaccompanied minors were evacuated from Afghanistan. The World's Shirin Jafari reports that some of them have already arrived in the United States, and now comes the daunting task of reuniting them with their families and helping them find a new home.
Hugs, smiles, and a tight embrace at Toronto Airport earlier this month as a three-year-old Afghan boy reunites with his father. Authorities are not giving his name, but he was separated from his family on August 26 when there was a suicide attack at the Kabul airport. He was put on a plane out of the country and spent 2 weeks at an orphanage in Qatar. Officials with the UN Refugee Agency helped reach his family in Canada, and he was able to reunite with them. But this boy is lucky. Right now, there are at least 300 Afghan children who were separated from their families during the evacuation. That's according to Wendy Young. She's the president of Kids in Need of Defense, an organization that provides support for unaccompanied minors.
We know of children whose parents were killed in the process, and we know of children who were separated and placed on a different flight than their parent or their guardian, and the child's in one country and the parents in another.
Young says in the aftermath of the evacuation at Kabul airport, a global effort began to help reunite Afghan children separated from their parents. There were also unaccompanied minors, children who evacuated with a friend or relative, and then some orphans. Most of the minors evacuated from Afghanistan are now on military bases in Germany and Qatar. Some have started arriving in the U.S. One place they're staying is at Fort Bliss Military Base in El Paso, Texas. Yesterday, about 75 Afghan minors arrived in Chicago, according to officials. Wendy Young says their immigration status right now is called humanitarian parole.
They've been evacuated, but they haven't been processed and vetted at the rigorous and frankly bureaucratic and lengthy process that normally happens through refugee resettlement. They haven't spontaneously arrived here, so this is why they're in parole status.
And that means this group of minors is facing a lot of uncertainty. These young Afghans do not have permanent legal status, Young says, because they're not yet designated as refugees, for example. Barbara Amarati is with the group Save the Children. She's been working with some of the children at Fort Bliss. And she says the first thing that happens with unaccompanied minors is that they are separated from the general population.
It's a very temporary accommodation. It's a small home, one room, and we've set it up. It looks like a bedroom with a welcoming living space.
No more than two minors, she says, stay in these facilities at a time. And most of them are between 15 and 17 years old. Emirati says these Afghan minors have been through a traumatic experience, but they are ready to start their lives in America.
they are happy to be in the United States. The first questions are, when can I go to school? If I go here, will I go to school? A university student is, you know, desperate to get back to classes.
People from the Afghan communities here in the U.S. are springing into action. For example, the Afghan American Foundation recently hosted a Zoom session to explain the process of becoming a foster parent. Nadia Hashemi, a pediatrician, started off the conversation.
For these children, this may be an event in their lives that stays very fresh. And I think trauma does that. Trauma has a really deep footprint on the soul. And so the easier and the more comforted we can have these children feel in this moment and in this process, the better it is.
About 800 people were on the call, Hashemi said. Unaccompanied children arriving in the U.S. is nothing new. Wendy Young from the Kids in Need of Defense says in recent years, the official response has been more about law enforcement than child protection. In the case of these Afghan children, she says, the approach is a work in progress.
What I hope happens is that we'll look back at it and figure out what lessons learned there are, because what we see, whether you're looking at the Central American situation or the Afghan situation, is that these kids need our help. And we really owe it to them to have a system in place that kicks in rapidly and ensures that they get everything that they need, including family reunification, where appropriate.
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Across American military bases right now, you'll find tens of thousands of Afghan refugees waiting for resettlement in the U.S. It's worth noting that this week, the Biden administration announced that it's raising the annual cap on refugees allowed into the U.S. to 125,000, double what was permitted last year. Krish Omara Vignaraja is president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, one of the agencies whose job it is to resettle refugees. So with this newly announced cap of 125,000 refugees for the coming fiscal year from the Biden White House, Krish, the Afghan refugees, the ones brought here by the U.S., will they be counted in that increased annual quota?
So most of the Afghans who are arriving will come in as humanitarian parolees. What we have been arguing for is an adjustment of status so that they can become refugees or special immigrant visa holders, because in terms of their eligibility, the reasons for why they are fleeing Afghanistan, they deserve that type of legal status that is more permanent. Right now, all they receive is 90 days of assistance from the State Department. We want to make sure that they receive the services that are more robust that would be available if they came in as a refugee or a special immigrant visa. And so for us, you know, at the end of the day, we just want to make sure that we set them up for success as they make a new home here.
I also think about the typical refugee resettlement route, often not under such pressure. People leave centers of conflict and wait in camps while the UN works with agencies and slowly people get resettled. How different is this situation where tens of thousands of people kind of show up in the U.S. at once?
Yeah, the last time that we've seen anything like this was in Vietnam, where we had 130,000 Vietnamese come to the U.S. And what's unique about this moment is that we are rebuilding the refugee resettlement structure after it was decimated over 4 years during the Trump era. And so it's not just rebuilding and having, you know, the time to do that over the course of a year. We are resettling today in a few weeks the number that we would have resettled over an entire year in the last few years.
Wow.
Across the network of 9 resettlement agencies, we had more than 100 offices that were closed during the Trump administration. So it's about getting those offices up and running. It's about rehiring staff, about retraining staff who may have been tasked with something else over the last couple years, but also engaging communities all across the country.
To what degree is your agency having to come up with the money to resettle refugees, or does the federal government give you most of what you need?
Unfortunately, in this case, the federal government does not. The State Department created an emergency program to help those Afghans arriving, but it only provides 90 days of assistance. So we have looked to the private sector for many things. Housing is one of our biggest challenges, so we've been grateful that Airbnb has stepped up. Uber has donated drives so that we can get individuals to medical appointments. Mm. Walmart has given us gift cards so that, you know, for those basic necessities, toothbrushes even, that we can get these families the basic supplies.
Krish, as you know, there is a crisis involving Haitians at the U.S.-Mexico border, but they are not considered refugees. Why not?
There is very little difference between traditional refugees and the Haitians trying to enter the southern border. Both are fleeing violence and persecution and are unable to return to their home country. The only difference between refugees and asylum seekers is where they apply for protection. So refugees cross an international border to seek protection in a third country. Asylum seekers like those coming from Haiti present themselves at the U.S. border or the U.S. interior and apply for protection. If they are granted it, they will become legal permanent residents, or they will become asylees who are then going to apply for legal permanent residence.
What has your organization said to the White House about this distinction?
We've argued for consistency. This administration, just a few weeks ago, extended temporary protected status for Haitians for the exact same conditions that Haitians are fleeing coming to our southern border. And so we believe that it's incredibly important for us to have the consistency to say that there are dire circumstances in Haiti as a result of sudden onset climate disaster to the fall of the government. And so these people are coming here desperately needing protection, basic support. We as a nation have a legal responsibility to provide them access to that legal right.
Krish Omara Vignaraja is president of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, one of the agencies that is tasked with resettling refugees. Krish, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
There's been some high drama in Washington lately, questions swirling around the Capitol about how much support to give an historically key American ally. Here's the world's Sarah Birnbaum.
A group of House Democrats got a lot of attention this week when they tried to block $1 billion in U.S. funding for Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. On the House floor, Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib called Israel an apartheid state.
We cannot be talking only about Israelis' need for safety at a time when Palestinians are living under a violent apartheid system and are dying from what Human Rights Watch has said are war crimes.
Soon after that, Florida Congressman Ted Deutch set aside his prepared remarks and went after his fellow Democrat, Rashida Tlaib.
I cannot allow one of my colleagues to stand on the floor of the House of Representatives and label the Jewish Democratic State of Israel an apartheid state. I reject it.
Deutch went on to say that his colleagues' remarks amounted to anti-Semitism. In the end, the funding bill for Israel's Iron Dome system passed overwhelmingly, 420-9. Some will see the political drama as same old, same old. The U.S. Congress is simply reaffirming its commitment to America's most important Middle East ally, Israel. But Yusuf Meneer says there was something different playing out in all this. He's a non-resident fellow at the Arab Center in Washington.
The proponents of this legislation wanted to ensure that it was framed as for defensive purposes. And I think that piece of it is interesting and is sort of a sign of the times.
The $1 billion in this particular bill is for the Iron Dome. It protects Israeli civilians from rockets fired by militant groups in Gaza and elsewhere. Meneer says the bill was written this way because it's not clear that support for offensive weapons, like planes and bombs, would have gotten through Congress.
There's a shift in the debate, in the conversation here in the United States about U.S. support for Israel.
Lara Friedman, the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, agrees. She says there was a time not too long ago when speeches like the one from Rashida Tlaib would have never happened on the House floor.
There is enormous courage. There are members of Congress who, knowing, particularly people like Rashida Tlaib, knowing that they are going to take a hit, are still willing to stand up and say, listen, I am going to vote my conscience. I am going to speak my truth.
That said, Friedman says the response to Tlaib and her colleagues was also unprecedented.
So if we're seeing more courage to speak out, we're also seeing a bigger hammer coming than we've seen in recent years.
Friedman says that's because there's fear, fear that the American public's opinion about Israel is becoming much more critical.
There's a concern that there are shifts in the grassroots, and those shifts in the grassroots, which are well documented by polling, are starting to be seen more and more in the results we're seeing in elections, and we're seeing people elected who are not beholden or don't feel responsible to maintain the same positions as their predecessors.
For now, the events on Capitol Hill this week do not appear to have changed the U.S.-Israel alliance in any big way. And experts say that's likely to remain the case under the Biden administration. But the political grounds in Washington do appear to be shifting when it comes to U.S. support for Israel. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A looming figure in German politics is about to exit the stage. Angela Merkel, who has led Germany for almost 16 years, is leaving her post as chancellor. When she was first sworn in,
Ich schwöre, dass ich meine Kraft dem Wohle des deutschen
Merkel said she'd use her power for the good of the German people.
Seinen Nutzen mehren, Schaden von ihm wenden, so wahr mir Gott helfe.
That was Angela Merkel back in 2005, some 16 years ago. So what's next for Germany after Merkel? That's on the agenda in this week's episode of The Economist Asks, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Anne McElvoy is the host and joins us now from Berlin. Anne, you've been watching and writing about Angela Merkel for over 30 years. When and where did you first meet her, and what were your impressions?
I first met Angela Merkel when she was a reform activist, as the Berlin Wall was falling and lots of new parties and splinter groups and mini parties were emerging. She positioned herself on the center right of the pro-democracy movements. And then I met her again when she was entering the Bundestag, that's the German parliament, at the first free elections in 1990. I said, these are the first free elections I've covered in East Germany. And she said, yes, they're mine as well. We had a bit of a laugh about that many years later. She recalled that conversation. It just shows you, doesn't it, Marco? Gosh, what a time Angela Merkel has covered in her political career.
Yeah, for sure. So in this episode of The Economist Asks, you spoke to Wolfgang Novak. He's a former advisor to Merkel's predecessor, Gerhard Schröder. What did he have to say about his former advisor and later adversary in the 2005 election?
I asked him why Merkel was such a tough act to follow. And one of the things that he pointed out, because there was a great battle for Merkel to get past the guy that Wolfgang Novak was advising, called Gerhard Schröder, but he emerged with great respect for her and thought she was politically extremely ruthless. A lot of people always tell me how wonderfully nice Angela Merkel is. Well, she is, but she didn't get where she is today by only being nice. So one of the things that we talked about was this mixed personality politically of Angela Merkel, who is both mutti, mummy, but at the same time, gosh, when mummy wants her way, well, she tends to get it.
Here's Wolfgang Novak.
She was called Mutti. I think you remember the Hillary Clinton debate with Obama in 2008. And when Hillary Clinton said, well, it's 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, suddenly the phone rings and something awful has happened. Whom do you want at the phone? Well, we, the Germans, for 16 years, we didn't even wake up because we knew Merkel is on the phone. And that has calmed us. Therefore, Germany became asleep. And now we have to wake up. And this is a big problem for the successor of Merkel, whoever he or she will be. We don't like change in Germany, and we will have to change. We will miss her, but she is gone, and Germany has slept too long. The mistake of Merkel was that she has kept a balance of unsolved problems, but now they will come. How do we deal with Poland? What should we do with the United States? Germany is too strong to be neglected by the European other countries, but it's not strong enough to impose our will.
That's Wolfgang Novak speaking about Angela Merkel. Novak was an advisor to Merkel's predecessor, Gerhard Schröder. Anne McElvoy, you met Merkel a couple of years ago at the World Economic Forum in Davos in Switzerland. Did she open up and talk about the highlights and lowlights of her tenure?
She was very relaxed, actually. And once she reconnected and realized that we'd met all those years ago, she said, well, you know, come aside after a little briefing of mainly American press, actually. And we sat and natted away in German about it. And she said one thing that stuck with me in a very Angela Merkel way. She said, oh, you always write about me with this very skeptical British look. But she has a bit of a sense of humor about it. And, you know, she was talking about handling Trump and, of course, the great difficulties and big divide politically between Angela Merkel's worldview and Donald Trump. But she did kind of say, you know, he gets away with a lot. I'm really interested in the way he gets away with it. She's sometimes much more irreverent, even witty in a quiet way, than this very stolid, very earnest front that she tends to put up.
What a rare window for you to meet Angela Merkel like that, on the sidelines of Davos and speaking with her in German.
It was great fun, I have to say. It was, as I say, much more irreverent than people imagine. To me, she is still very much a product of the old East Germany. She's a little bit skeptical about America. I don't mean that in the way of being hostile, but she would say, well, you know, the Americans always talk like this, or even under Clinton, the Americans were a bit protectionist about trade. So she has a quite, shall we say, a view of the world that is not only of the international elites who are all hugger-mugger and pretend they all get along all the time. It's a little bit sharper, and I'm sure that's the view that comes across in her inner circle. Someone said to me that she never talks about winning and losing. She says, that was a good result.
Hmm. So, Anne, let's turn to this Sunday's elections in Germany. You're in Berlin right now, as I said. Whom did you speak to in the podcast about this vote and the candidates?
I spoke to Claudia Major, who is a well-known security expert here at Germany's biggest foreign and security policy think tank. And what I wanted to know from her, and you be aware that the beginning of the Biden administration has been seen, Marco, is a bit bumpy, frankly, in Europe. So there are lots of views here really about what Germany should do about that. What is this transatlantic alliance worth? What does it mean to be a member of NATO after the disaster of Afghanistan? I don't think Germans feel very happy about that. Neither do a lot of Americans. And I asked Claudia Major to basically just give us a thumbnail on each of the candidates.
We have two candidates, the Social Democrats, Olaf Scholz, and the Conservative, Armin Laschet, who portray themselves very much as candidates of continuity. And then we have the Green candidate, Annalena Baerbock, who portrays herself really as a candidate of change. If you look at the contents, how do they differentiate each other in, say, China, Russia, defense spending, and nuclear issues? What we see is whatever is going to happen, whoever's going to be in the new government, we will have a change in the China policy. Recognizing China more as a systemic rival, how hawkish it will really be in the end depends on who is going to be in government. And if I look at the Greens, they very clearly call for a mix of dialogue on things like climate change, but certain robustness on human rights, on increasing resilience on exports and imports. It's a bit softer with the Conservatives, for example.
Claudia Major there talking about the main candidates competing to be Germany's next leader. Anne McElvoy, what will you be watching for this Sunday as you cover the national elections in Germany?
I think if we're seeing something that looks fundamentally like a shift of Germany in what you might call the red-green direction, as they say here, very simply putting the colours on the parties, that would be a decisive move to the centre-left after all those years of the Merkel-led centre-right consensus, yes, but effectively centre-right driven view of government across Germany. That would be a really interesting shift. Or whether Armin Laschet, the candidate who has the difficult job of trying to step into Angela Merkel's shoes for the Christian Democrats, does he somehow hold on? At the moment, it seems like Social Democrats on the centre-left are ahead, but it is not impossible that he could drive his vote out, bring back those waverers in the last few days, and still find that the centre-right are in the coalition, in which case it's a bit like putting together a stir fry. You know, is it going to be more mushrooms, or is it going to be more beef, or should we just have a few more noodles? It's going to be very interesting, these constituent parts, who gets what, who gets which office of state is really what this race is all about. So I'm doing a long night on Sunday.
Anne McElvoy, host of The Economist Asks. You can hear more on the German elections wherever you download your podcasts. Anne, good to speak with you again. I hope you get some sleep at some point.
So do I.
You're listening to The World. COVID rules can be confusing for travelers. For Indians who are actually vaccinated, they're confused why it's hard to enter the UK.
UK government seems to be insulting willfully the Indian government's certification methods.
And we remember the revolutionary spirit of filmmaking pioneer Melvin Van Peebles. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We're about to enter what a friend of mine calls puffy vest season here in New England, meaning it's not quite cold enough to bust out the winter coat, but you still need an extra layer of insulation. If you need a new vest this season, best to get your orders in now. Retailers are scrambling to get their clothes shipped over from Asia, retailers like Eddie Bauer. Damian Huang is CEO of the outdoor retailer and joins me now from Seattle. So I know the last year has been pretty much a nightmare for retailers, Damian. Is it more of the same this fall, or have things gotten worse in the past few weeks?
Well, things have gotten worse and better. Last year, the industry, the economy was racked by COVID. And one of the actions retailers took was to dramatically cut inventories. For a business like ours, however, people really turned to the outdoors for their own physical and mental well-being. And our business held up really well and has continued to be quite strong over this year. So now as people try to get back into inventory and recalibrate how many goods we have, there's a surge in imports.
There are a lot of clothing retailers in the U.S. like you, and most of those products for them come over on ships from Asia. Right now, there are delays. What's causing those delays?
The entire network is clogged, and it's really driven in the simplest sense by demand. We are reaching all-time highs for container shipping across the globe. And couple that with disruptions in the labor market and port operations by COVID outbreaks and other factors. And what you have here is a very clogged, very congested, and now delayed system.
And can you at Eddie Bauer, given your scale, can you do anything to adapt in the short run? Or are you just stuck for a while?
Well, we can do some things to adapt, but obviously we're at the mercy of a global economic logistics system that is beyond the power of any single retailer, no matter how large. So we are doing some things, and it is a day-to-day battle to try and find container space, reroute things. So we are juggling everything we possibly can to try and maintain the delivery of goods for our business.
And so what happens in a few weeks if the logjam doesn't kind of ease up? You just run out of clothes you can deliver? I mean, what's your inventory like right now?
That is one possibility. I think we won't run out of clothes, but things are going to be very tight for a lot of people throughout the holiday season. If I have advice to customers right now, it is, as you said, if you see something you think you might like, you should probably get it early. Otherwise, the message is going to be patience and flexibility.
Damien, has this whole situation made you rethink how you do business, maybe manufacturing more clothes here in the U.S.? Or is this a short-term problem that you've identified and it's just not worth it to crash the supply chain business model?
No, I think we have started taking steps towards reevaluating how and where we make our goods. And I think we're everybody is looking for ways to take less risk out of any one particular region and rebalance the overall footprint we have as a manufacturer. So that is absolutely something we are looking into for next year. Unfortunately, those levers do take some time to develop and operate, so they're not quick solutions.
Earlier this week, Damien, we were talking about the blockages at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach in California, vessels coming from Asia with lots of goods on them. Are you watching those ports? And, you know, how much of your own inventory is affected by just those two places?
Well, we're watching those ports. I do wake up every morning and actually get a satellite view of the ships docked outside Port of Long Beach in LA, if you can imagine that. We do have a high percentage of goods, and virtually all of them that are on the water will experience some form of a delay. Every port on the West Coast and many on the East Coast, in addition to the truck and rail networks that take goods from ports into our distribution center, will be delayed over the next month. We have at this moment over 250 containers full of goods that are in transit, and we expect most of those will hit some form of a delay. Unfortunately, that's unavoidable.
Damien Huang is the CEO of retailer Eddie Bauer, speaking with us from Seattle. Damien, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Here's a supply-side problem of a much different sort. Europe isn't getting enough natural gas, and prices there are soaring. Some EU lawmakers think Russia might be partly to blame. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Stacey Stothard from North Yorkshire in England did what most of us do when we're trying to save a little money. She shopped around, and in August, she found a new energy provider that she believed would give her the best bang for her buck.
I was with British Gas and I moved to a utility company called Utility Point. And moving was going to save me around £355.
A week ago, that company went bust. It was one of seven energy companies in Britain that's gone out of business in just a matter of weeks. Several more are reported to be on the brink. The providers are blaming it all on the rising price of natural gas. In the last month alone, prices have jumped in the UK by 70%. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said this week, it's all because the world's economy is firing back up.
People should understand the short-term nature of this, the causes of it. It's caused by the global economy coming back to life.
But there are several other factors. It's been the least windy summer in Britain since the early 1960s, so wind turbines haven't been producing as much power as usual. A vital electricity cable between the UK and France was shut down after a fire. And Britain has one other big problem.
And the UK, compared to the rest of Europe, is particularly vulnerable because it's highly reliant on natural gas.
Michael Bradshaw is Professor of Global Energy at Warwick Business School.
It provides 30% of final energy consumption, and of particular importance going into the winter. 85% of households heat their homes with natural gas.
And here is a problem for regular folks like Stacey Stothard. She's worried about what's going to happen with her energy bills.
I looked on price comparison websites, you know, when this first broke, and to try and get a comparable deal was going to cost me £550 more.
Stothard tells me she's frustrated, but she says she knows she's one of the lucky ones because she's not going to go destitute if her gas bill skyrockets. Britain's business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, dismissed these sorts of concerns in Parliament this week.
There is absolutely no question, Mr. Speaker, of the lights going out or people being unable to heat their homes. Such thinking is alarmist, unhelpful and completely misguided.
Adam Scorer with National Energy Action, a fuel poverty charity, is not so sure.
We pray for a mild winter, but if it's cold and cold for any significant period of time, then we will see some really quite tragic ways in which people have to cope. You know, we say there's a choice between heating and eating.
Anti-poverty campaigners across Europe are worried too. Energy prices have jumped across the continent, and some EU lawmakers are now asking whether Russia is taking advantage of the situation by lowering its gas supplies to Europe in order to drive up demand and prices. Gazprom, the Russian-owned gas company, says absolutely not. Then there's speculation about Nord Stream 2. It's the controversial Russian-owned pipeline to Germany that US officials have complained about for years. Energy expert Michael Bradshaw says it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that Russia is using this crisis to get its pipeline approved.
There have been suggestions both from the Kremlin and from Gazprom that if that approval were to be given quite quickly, then the gas market in Europe might rebalance, which suggests that Russia could send more gas if the conditions were right. And so that does suggest some sort of geopolitical leverage.
But some experts think there could be another reason behind Russia's reluctance to send more gas to Europe. Thierry Bros is a member of the EU-Russia Gas Advisory Council.
I think it's more because Gazprom Russia is a bit fed up with the Green Deal narrative and the fact that investment in oil and gas is passé.
The EU says it wants to be carbon neutral by 2050. It plans to cut its share of natural gas to about a tenth of current consumption. But Bros says this year's energy emergency puts Europe in a bit of a pickle.
Are we going to say, well, the end station is net zero, but en route we are going to need more gas and not less gas? And this is something very difficult when for the last few years you've been just dealing with the EU Green Deal.
Bros says he's not sure how all of this will end. But events in just the past few weeks could prove a warning to Boris Johnson and other EU leaders that their ambitious plans for going green may not come easy. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Planning a trip abroad has never been trickier. Different countries, different policies. Do you need vaccines, rapid tests? Do you have to quarantine upon arrival? And who gets to come in? Details from an upcoming UK policy update drew fire from some countries recently. Many African and Latin American nations were left off the approved list, and many vaccines were deemed not good enough to skip the quarantine. Joining me now from the UK to sort this all out is Sanjoy Bhattacharya. He teaches the history of medicine at York University and also directs the WHO's Centre for Global Health Histories. Professor, let's look first at the UK policy, taking India as an example, because it's a compelling example right now. Fully vaccinated Indians need to quarantine arriving in the UK. Explain this.
Well, it surprises me because Indians, many Indians have received the AstraZeneca vaccine, which when produced in India is called the Covishield vaccine. It's interesting that at least 4 million people in the UK have also received this vaccine and are considered fully vaccinated in the United Kingdom. So the problem, as I see it, arises from who has vaccinated. And the UK government seems to think that brown hands vaccinating in India are in some way inferior. So there is a sort of race element to it, which hasn't yet played out in public policy. But I think in the coming days, we're going to have, I think, very direct accusations of racism being leveled at the UK government.
So people in India, as you said, receive a version of the AstraZeneca vaccine called Covishield. How does it compare with AstraZeneca that's used in the UK?
It's the same thing.
And yet India is not on the list of countries approved to go to the UK with quarantine waivers. What's the opinion of people in India who want to travel to the UK? Are you following reaction there?
Yes. And I can sense a palpable sense of anger about these double standards and the fact that somehow UK government seems to be insulting willfully insulting the Indian government's certification methods.
Does this surprise you, Professor? I mean, despite colonialism, there have been many strong ties between India and the UK over the years.
It stuns me because just like our Prime Minister Boris Johnson is trying to get a free trade deal with President Biden, Boris Johnson is also extremely keen to get a free trade deal with India. And to insult India's technological abilities in this way is not the best way to get a deal.
So India is not the only country missing from the list of countries whose fully vaccinated nationals are exempt from coming or quarantining. There are no African or Latin American nations included. You teach the history of medicine, Professor. Historically, does this follow a pattern?
There has always been a direct link between inequalities, power, and health. And that political inequality has always translated into high-income country governments painting low-income countries as reservoirs of dirt, filth, and source of infection, when that's oversimplification, and we're now in the 21st century, and we should be thinking in more non-racial and more democratic and inclusive terms, and that's just not happening in relation to COVID.
What do you see as a better solution? Like, how does a country create policies to keep COVID at bay, but also not to go overboard?
So testing is very important, even if you're vaccinated. If there is a strong, well-run, humane quarantining system provided by countries where people are arriving for travel or business or tourism or to meet family, then you are less likely to have a situation where people try to escape quarantine or don't follow the quarantine rules. So by stopping the spread of the virus, of the infection, governments actually save money by limiting infection in this present day.
Sanjoy Bhattacharya teaches the history of medicine at York University in the UK. Thank you for speaking with us.
Well, thank you so much.
This summer, South America accounted for about a quarter of all COVID deaths worldwide. Now, with vaccination rates increasing, cases there have fallen dramatically. Most South American nations have even dropped their travel restrictions. But there is one group of South Americans still struggling to get shots, Venezuelans who fled the crisis in their country. From the Colombian capital, Bogota, Manuel Rueda has more.
Juntos se puede, or in English, together we can, is a foundation that helps Venezuelan migrants in Colombia. The lobby here is full of people. Some are looking for help with residency applications. Others have come to ask about coronavirus vaccines. Many Venezuelan migrants still haven't gotten their shots because vaccination centers in Colombia require national ID cards or proof of residency. For Isel Toledo, that's tough. She entered Colombia without permission a few years ago. When I came in, nobody stamped my passport, she says. If I were a legal resident, it wouldn't be a problem to get the vaccine, but now it's harder. Colombia is home to 1.8 million Venezuelan migrants and refugees who have fled that nation's humanitarian crisis. Around 1 million of them are undocumented, and they're struggling to get vaccines. Last year, Colombia's President Iván Duque said that undocumented immigrants would be left out of the nation's vaccination program. We would have a stampede of people crossing the border, trying to get vaccinated, Duque said on a radio show. This month, the Ministry of Health ordered city governments to make lists of migrants who need vaccines, so that they can get shots later this year. Victor Uribe from Together We Can says that in the meantime, his group is sending some undocumented migrants to the International Organization for Migration. The IOM has been able to get shots for a few thousand people. It's been a complicated process, Uribe says. The demand for vaccines is high. And we also have people coming from Venezuela just to get vaccinated. Venezuela has one of the lowest vaccination rates in Latin America. In Peru, less than 10% of Venezuelan residents have been vaccinated, according to official statistics. That's because vaccination centers in some parts of the country are still asking for national ID cards. In Chile, many undocumented Venezuelans have stayed away from vaccination centers over fears of being deported. The United Nations is urging governments in South America and elsewhere to simplify vaccination requirements and stop asking for national ID cards. According to the Organization of American States, it's not even that expensive to vaccinate all of the Venezuelan refugees in Latin America. David Smolansky is the organization's envoy for the Venezuelan refugee crisis. He says there are 5.4 million displaced Venezuelans in Latin America. Getting shots for all of them would cost around $165 million, Smolansky says. And international donors have pledged more than $1.5 billion in aid for Venezuelan refugees.
Vaccinating Venezuelan migrants or refugees will not only protect them, but will also protect the societies in Latin America and the Caribbean that are receiving them.
In Colombia's capital, rules have been loosened somewhat to help undocumented migrants from Venezuela. Those who can show they have completed an application for temporary protected status are now welcome at vaccination centers. To apply for TPS, Venezuelans must answer a 70-question survey online, upload a personal photo, and provide documents showing they have been in Colombia since January. Those steps can take some time and effort, but for many migrants, it's worth it. In the lobby of Together We Can, Oriana Fernandez shows me a sheet with a QR code, proving she's completed her TPS application. With this, you can get vaccinated, she says. It took her 3 days to fill out the form and find supporting documents. It was tough, she says, but we all need to get vaccinated so we can get rid of this virus. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
Some sad news from the world of film this week. Melvin Van Peebles, the pioneering black filmmaker, died on Tuesday at the age of 89 at his home in Manhattan. He was known as the godfather of modern black cinema. His movies burst with the sounds of soul and funk and resistance. Van Peebles leaves an immense legacy in American and world cinema. Here to talk with us about his life is Raquel Gates, professor of film at Columbia University. Van Peebles was something of a Renaissance man. Raquel, a novelist, musician, painter, worked in the theater, and of course, was a filmmaker. How influential and widespread was his work?
You know, I think we really cannot emphasize enough how immensely influential he was, not just in terms of his storytelling practices, but also his labor practices. I mean, Van Peebles really figured out a way to work outside of the Hollywood system, as well as figuring out ways to sort of articulate his vision in really subversive ways within the Hollywood studio system.
There is a certain generation of filmmakers in Africa who are influenced by his work. What did those African directors see in Melvin Van Peebles' work that they did not see elsewhere in Hollywood?
I mean, I think what filmmakers around the globe saw was somebody from a community, from a marginalized community, telling his own story and telling the story of people who had been overlooked and ignored or misrepresented by Hollywood. And we see that within the context of the 1960s, part of the Black Arts Movement here in the United States, but also larger global and national cinemas. And I'm thinking of somebody like Santiago Alvarez in Cuba, people who were really interested in using film as a way of articulating a political vision and giving attention to individuals and communities that had been long overlooked.
Do you know how Melvin Van Peebles felt about how his work impacted directors in other parts of the world? Like, did he feel he connected with an audience he had not expected?
I think that he had a very strong vision of what he wanted to bring to people. Mm. And I think that his sort of attitude was, if people come, they come. If they don't, they don't. But he had an innate sense of confidence in what he was doing and the importance of what he was doing.
So more of an intentional revolutionary director.
Absolutely an intentional revolutionary director. I mean, just such a clear sense of vision and purpose, and also a clear sense of where his art practice fit into larger conversations.
He lived for some time in France, I gather. Why did he move there, and what effect did that have on his career and his life?
So, you know, Melvin Van Peebles was living in San Francisco, and he tells the story of trying to make it as an American filmmaker, but, you know, the sort of racism of the industry made that impossible. And so he picks up his family, you know, has all kinds of different jobs. At one point, he was a street performer in France. You know, he was an actor on the stage in the Netherlands for a bit. But it's in France that he's able to sort of make the connections in order to make the film that he wants to make and really sort of develop and hone his craft.
And was he able to achieve that in France?
Absolutely. I mean, the story of a three-day pass, people talk about it in terms of sort of the ways that it deals with racism. It's the story of an American GI and his relationship with a white French woman comes out the same year as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, starring Sidney Poitier. But it's a completely sort of different lens that Melvin Van Peebles is using and really sort of looking at the psychological state of the main character. But the thing that people don't talk about enough is it's such an amazing and experimental film in terms of its aesthetics. It's clear that he's sort of in conversation with the French New Wave filmmakers. You know, there's a really amazing shot, a double dolly shot, which Spike Lee has made famous, this kind of shot where it looks like a character's floating through space. And, you know, Melvin Van Peebles uses that, and this is 1967.
For your own scholarly research, Raquel, you've met and interviewed Melvin Van Peebles at his home. Give us a sense of what he was like.
It's a kind of a crazy story. I had a mutual contact. I was writing an academic article about Watermelon Man, and I asked this contact, you know, I'd love to chat with him. Do you know how to get in touch with him? And this contact gave me a phone number, and I thought it was a secretary or something. So, you know, I called, and Melvin Van Peebles answers the phone, you know? So,
wow.
and I said, I'd love to chat with you. And he says, well, if you can get here in 20 minutes, I'll chat with you for like 10 minutes or something like that. And so I jump on the subway, and I go over to his apartment. I mean, he's in the phone book, which is sort of insane to me. You know, he welcomed me in. We sat for 2 hours. And, you know, he was just so incredibly generous with his time and with his knowledge and talked to me about making that film, but also his experiences in Hollywood and, you know, his sort of thoughts on representation. And that's one of the things that's really sort of come out the more that people have been talking about him is just his immense generosity to people.
So just as Van Peebles dies this week, there are new audiences learning about his work. Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song is screening at the New York Film Festival this weekend. A revival of his play, Ain't Supposed to Die a Natural Death, is slated for return to Broadway next year. What do you think all that says about his work and how his legacy is going to live on?
People talk about Melvin Van Peebles usually in the context of the 1960s and 1970s. But what I think this demonstrates is that, you know, the stuff that he was exploring, these ideas of Black liberation and sort of elevating ordinary people to the level of figures really worth celebrating and really worth watching on film. I think there's a universality and a timelessness about that. And I think particularly now where people of color, both in the United States, but also around the globe, are still fighting some of these same battles, right? To have their lives celebrated and fight just to be recognized for their humanity. Those themes are just as relevant and significant as they were then.
Well, there has been so much scrutiny of the lack of diversity in Hollywood in recent years, from pre-production to acting to direction to post-production. Oscar is so white. How do you think Melvin Van Peebles' process, where this arc landed in recent years, as someone who was determined to bring justice to the system?
I think that Melvin Van Peebles recognized early on that the system is inherently broken. His response to that was, in the 60s, Hollywood won't let me be a filmmaker. Screw it, I'll go to France. When he wants to film a particular ending for Watermelon Man and Columbia Pictures tells him, no, we want a different ending, he just lies to them, right? He tells them he's going to shoot 2 endings. He only shoots one. He breaks down the sets. He sends everybody home. And he puts Columbia in this position where they have no choice but to use his preferred ending. When he wants to make Sweetback and he realizes that that's never going to be a Hollywood film, he just does his own thing. I mean, I think that his response would be, you know, when Hollywood is closing the door, you find your own way, you craft your own path, you find a new way to do the thing that you want to do, and you don't let people tell you no.
Raquel Gates is a professor of film at Columbia University. She's also the consulting producer and editor for the Melvin Van Peebles box set being released by the Criterion Collection next week for really deep dives into the filmmaker, Melvin Van Peebles, who died this week at the age of 89. Raquel, really great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you can carve out some time this weekend to watch some good movies. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, have fun. We'll see you back here Monday.